Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Mlondi Mluli. Mlondi, how are you doing, man?
I'm good, and you, Nick? How are you doing? And thanks for having me again on the show.
Yeah, no, absolute pleasure, sir. How am I doing? I'm doing okay. I've got a lot of things to do today, including I have to think of a column to write, but that's not your problem. Or Terence's problem. And of course, we also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm good, Nicholas. Just a bit cold.
Yes. And Terence is going to be on holiday soon. So I hope that he gets all the rest he deserves, because he's been putting in a lot of titanic effort recently. So anyway, before we start the show, we are, of course, sponsored by bitvice.io. Bitcoin is a complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet, where you hold the keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And we thank them very much for sponsoring us. All right, let us get into the show. So the first topic for today is the public protector, Mkhwebane, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, who is currently facing Parliament, who are considering whether to impeach her or not. She has been a controversial figure since her appointment, to say the least, losing numerous court battles against various entities throughout her tenure. But there were some pretty wild allegations made recently by a former employee in her office about her conduct. A former investigator in her office was testifying before Parliament and said that she had received orders from the state security agency, the SSA, to push for the Parliament to amend South Africa's Reserve Bank's mandate, to change it so that basically that its mandate would be from, instead of protecting the currency, to serving the interests of the people or something like that. So basically, this has kind of been a Zuma faction demand for a long time, that the SARB be nationalized, is the term they usually say. So further than this, the people in her office testified that she had also ordered that meetings held with SSA boss Arthur Fraser not be recorded, which was completely unusual. One of the investigators said that that the normal course of action was to record basically everything that the public protector was involved for later reference. She ordered, however, that these meetings in particular not be recorded. And that this was, quote, entirely out of the ordinary. The investigator who was testifying said, I had always recorded every meeting which I attended with the public protector, either in the form of an audio recording or in writing. The public protector was, of course, aware that this was standard procedure. Dali Mpofu was, shall we say, denying these claims, but he didn't have time to address all of them. Mkhwebane, and mainly he didn't really address Mkhwebane's, the allegation that Mkhwebane had unlawfully instructed that the SARS constitutional mandate be changed. There was also this strange aspect to the story that News 24 reported, which is that the proposal for changing the SARB that she was reportedly endorsing was one written by a guy called Goodson, who's a sort of a strange fellow, previously part of the South African Reserve Bank's board, but also has a sort of strange streak in that he denies the Holocaust and has written a book about how central banking is the enslavement of mankind, and has previously praised Hendrik Verwoerd, so shall we say a controversial figure to say the least. Mkhwebane was asked about meeting him and basically adopting his proposal, and she said, I was not meeting him as a Holocaust denier or as a praiser of Hendrik Verwoerd. I was meeting him as a former shareholder of the Reserve Bank, which is a very amusing quote, I think. Anyway, so she was asked by a reporter to respond to these allegations that she had essentially been doing work on behalf of the state security agency to take down the Reserve Bank. And she said, "I'll never plot with any other person to deal with the Reserve Bank." She was also accused of collaborating with President Jacob Zuma. And she said, "I did everything I did in my investigation. I did independently from the presidency. And this is a totally uncalled for and wrong insinuation." Mlondi, could we have seen this coming, that the public protector was going to be a controversial figure?
Definitely, Nicholas. I saw it coming. And I guess it's not just me that, you know, that saw it coming. I guess almost everyone, I can guess, that's saw it coming. Because, you know, I'm not really a fan of her, and I've never been a fan of her. So I'm one of the, guys that are supporting this impeachment. You know, we've seen, you know, in the past that you know, that she's not the best of the you know, out of the public offices. You know that
right, particularly when you compare it to Tuli Madonsela.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, So I'm not really surprised by this, and it's another sign that she should be impeached, in my opinion.
No, definitely. I mean, presumably, you know, these are still allegations and not proven at this stage, but they are, shall we say, they need to be answered. Terence, what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, I like to make my pop cultural references. For those of you with small children, you've probably seen the Disney animated Aladdin and Parrot Iago, who says, "Oh, I'm about to keel over and die from not surprised." I think this is a train smash set in motion from the time that she was that she was nominated, and I think the big reveal here was the fact that a big mark was placed on the office of the public protector after Tuli Madonsela had done, I think, a great deal to shift public and elite opinion around around Jacob Zuma. You know, it was one thing, you know, to call attention to the Nkandla fire pool and whatever. When it had her imprimatur in it, it became something that you just couldn't walk away from. And he tried. You know, he tried to row back and say, "Well, I've got these other, like, you know, six processes in train, and we're going to wait for them all to come out, and then we'll react." And I think that essentially when she departed, it was something that this was a kind of never again situation. They were not going to, you know, have someone with her kind of with this kind of influence taking up that position. Now, it was interesting, and I must confess that I didn't quite see it this way, but I think it was Glynis Breytenbach who said right at the beginning during the hearings that there's something a bit off with this state security agency connection. I thought, well, that's maybe a bit of politicking, but, you know,
no, I think Breytenbach was the first time I've been wrong. right on the money on that one. I remember that. I believe the EFF went very heavily to bat for her initially as well, which was an interesting bit of politicking because, of course, you know, presumably the EFF's usual stance is to oppose almost everything the government does. Mm. And yet they were very supportive of her for no other reason than they said that her opponents were trying to tear her down because she was a black woman. which is usually a sign that something is afoot when racial politicking is sort of brought into something out of the blue.
When all else fails, play the identity card.
Indeed. I did ask you, I think last week, Blondie, whether she'll be impeached or not, and I know you said yes. It seems to me that that's only more certain now. Do you agree?
Yes, I do agree, and especially now after these events. Well, if they're true, then it'll definitely be it, you know, for her. So it's looking good so far, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, well, we can only hope because, as the previous, you know, the previous two occupants were the current occupant and the previous occupant have shown, the Office of Public Protector is, I think, quite an influential one, and failure to utilize it, you know, when we have someone who's, shall we say, I think, not doing the best in the public interest holding that office, it's not always a great thing. All right, do you have any final thing to say?
you know, this is an office that's bounced up and down. Selby Bako was I think a decent public protector. Lawrence Mushwana, you know, did many of the same kind of Mkhwabane-esque tricks. I remember that he famously decided that there wasn't really a problem with the you know, shenanigans around fuel, because it lost its character as public money after it had exited the system, and therefore we couldn't possibly talk about that. Tuli Maronsela, I think, very good. And you know, we're back to where we started. But I think there's something interesting here. Selby Bako was criticized at the time of his appointment, I think with some justification, because he had been taken out of an ANC National Council of Provinces seat, and you know, put in this position, and I think that was concerning. But back at that stage, the caliber of people that the ANC had in its ranks was just exponentially better than what it has now. The other point, I think, is we focus on the public protector, but I think maybe the other thing is, you know, South Africans, SSA. It's interesting how SS has a certain historical significance.
And not a that, good one.
Not a good one. And I think that is a far more serious problem. Mkhwabane will go one way or the other. The like rot inside our intelligence agencies, that can be really, really fatal. That's kind of like a cancer that you can't see until it's too late.
Indeed. And it is something I think that Ramaphosa has kind of alluded to being a problem, but has not really addressed, despite the fact that his factional enemies inside the ANC seem to be in control of the SSA. Right. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. So there has recently been a bit of discussion in the media about firearms control. This is in light of the recent spate of horrific shootings that have happened in taverns across the country. One of the worst being in Soweto, I think it was 2 weeks ago now, on Sunday, when a group of armed men went into a shebeen and shot, I think it was 15 people. It was a lot of people all at once. And this, of course, sparked a debate with News 24 editor Adrien Bosson writing a piece about how the country needs stricter gun control laws to prevent the scourge of gun violence. And there have been other articles in the media in the following days. Terence, you and I have both written on this topic. What do you make of the calls for more gun control?
Well, I think that I think one has to separate these things out. It's a highly emotive issue, and I think, unfortunately, it's the kind of extreme voices on both sides that dominate the conversation. The important point is that South Africa actually does not have permissive firearm laws, nor does it have by global standards an exceptionally high level of firearm ownership, and that's even if you add in the illegal firearms. Our firearm ownership rate is about 9.8 per hundred, I think, and that's sort of middling. Just by comparison, Sweden has about 24 per hundred. Now, you know, this is Pacific orderly Sweden, and I think most people would assume that there's not a firearm in sight there, but it has a very big hunting culture. And most of those guns are legal. So with sort of almost with nearly five times the number of guns, if we only take our legally owned against their legally owned, yet they just don't shoot each other the way we do. So there are clearly many other factors. The other thing is that if one assumes, as seems to be the case, that an AK was used in this attack, that is already classified as a restricted firearm. It's almost impossible for a civilian to own that. You can get a kind of a semi-deactivated one that fires a repeat pulls, but not the kind of bang bang bang. Now it seems that there was something I read that it seems that this particular gun may have originated in security force stocks in Botswana. we'll have to see. But the point is that this almost certainly was not a gun that had gone through any kind of legal system, legal check in South Africa. And therefore, you can implement all the gun control you like. You are simply not going to take a gun like that out of circulation. To do that, you need crime intelligence would be a big one. You need appropriate controls against trafficking. Yet we have borders that are extremely porous. The place we start here is that there is a legitimate conversation to be had about the level of gun control, the level of regulation you want, what firearms people might can reasonably expect to be permitted to own. But I don't think that is a particularly important or instructive issue in this particular case. Here, there's just so many laws broken or ignored up to this point that changing those laws would have minimal effect.
No, I agree completely with you on the porous borders thing. I think we do suffer from the fact that South Africa is sort of, firstly, in a neighborhood with a lot of countries that have long histories of conflict and violence, right, such as Mozambique, which of course means that there's lots of firearms sort of sloshing around in hidden caches there. I mean, of course, we do have an ISIS cell in northern Mozambique next door who are being smuggled weapons constantly. So you can imagine how some of those might find their way into the hands of gangs. There's a lot of the armed forces, never mind our own armed forces and police, but neighboring countries have, you know, I can't expect that, you know, for example, the Mozambican or the Zimbabwean militaries to be, shall we say, incredibly trustworthy custodians of firearms, right? So I can imagine them selling those off to gangs. So we do suffer from that, and the fact that so many things cross our borders. And also, I think that we're a transit point for a lot of drugs and illegal goods going to first world countries. Right. So it's, you know, as long as those networks exist, it's going to be really difficult to prevent the flow of illegal firearms into the country.
Right.
Mlondi, we were talking a little bit about this before the show. There was a particular stat that stuck in your mind in our discussion about this.
Yes, Nicholas. It's the stat that you guys made with regards to Jamaica, because they have all these strict laws and, you know, like all these gun control laws. But actually, you found that it actually has a high umber rate of 44.9%. So that actually defeats the purpose of what Adrian is trying to say, because he's saying that you need more gun laws and more gun control. But then we have a stats, you know, that says that a country like Jamaica, you know, like gun laws, but the umber rate
is not high, only 9%. Yeah, which is, it's not only that it, you know, Jamaica has restrictive firearms legislation, it's you know, it's an island society that in theory should be able to better control its borders.
True.
And yet it still has a serious problem of murder.
Yeah, look, I think that, you know, Adrien Besson was referring this, his reference point was Japan.
Right.
And he says something, why can't we follow suit? Well, we can't follow suit because we are not Japan. Japan has had control of weapons, and this includes swords, bows, whatever, that goes back to 1588. And interestingly, it was stated explicitly in the decree that outlawed this, that it makes it difficult to collect taxes, just so we know. Firearms or weapons have never been a part of Japanese culture since, you know, except amongst the sort of elite. This doesn't mean that
specifically Japan the warrior elite.
Yeah, it doesn't mean Japan hasn't had violence. In the 1920s and 30s, it was called governing by assassination. You know, the rise of the militarists in Japan was in some ways more violent than, you know, the rise of the fascists in Italy or the Nazis in Germany. Post World War II, though, there was no history of this, so there was it was just never an issue. In fact, it was the American occupation authorities that started to insist Japanese police had to carry firearms. Plus, Japan has a state-of-the-art civil service, very intrusive. It also has a very harachat penal system. You know, they were 99% of murder cases end in a conviction, and it's not necessarily because 99% of those people are guilty. There's a lot of reliance delicately put on confessions. You also have a culture in which, you know, shame and being, you know, outed carries a huge stigma. Just in the language people use around you, you go from being sort of Mr. So-and-so to suspect so-and-so. So, yeah, you know, we're not Japan. Now, Jamaica has very much, very similar laws. They have a quasi-Japanese model. In fact, they even have a separate court to try firearms offenses. And there's been very disturbing things said about that although you are protected by rules of evidence, the testimony of a police officer generally is taken as gospel. And you go away basically for the rest of your life. Yet, and this has been going since the 1970s, Jamaica remains one of the most violent, dangerous societies in the world.
Right, as Mlondi said, even more dangerous than us in terms of murder.
So, by a considerable margin.
Yeah, it's clear that you know, when it comes to levels of violence in society, the issues that affect it are fairly complex. I wonder if a much stronger correlation than firearm ownership is prevalence of gangs in the country and how entrenched gangs are. I mean, that certainly explains some of our murder rate in the Western Cape, I think.
Absolutely. Look, you know, I'll say one other thing, and this is a point we've discussed. When the correlations are very shaky, but when people start mentioning numbers, it's a good idea to say, time out, what are you talking about? Are you talking about murder? Are you talking about firearm murder? Are you talking about deaths by guns? Now, in the United States, where this has been extensively studied, gun deaths, more than half of them are actually suicides. Now, you can argue about whether removing weapons from a situation like that would make people more secure. It's a reasonable debate, but don't conflate somebody who's, you know, severely depressed, you know, living alone, isolated, and wanting to end it all, with a, you know, 18-year-old psychopath who wants to walk into a school and go out in a blaze of glory. Right. The other thing is that I think we often focus on the sensational, and I think the reason we do is that, you know, it is newsworthy. Tavern shootings are not, as far as I can establish, very common in South Africa, which is maybe why they made the news and you had the spate of them. Far more common in South Africa for murder is, you know, abusive spouses or romantic partners bludgeoning their partners.
Or people stabbing each other in shebeens.
You know, in the same way, you know, everyone knows that there's this epidemic of school shootings in America, but they account for, I think, less than 3% of firearm deaths. Most American deaths are, as you say, gangs, drug deals gone wrong, drunk people, abusive partners, and more than half of them, as I say, are people who end their own life. And, you know, as I say, I don't say that with any disrespect, and I think that the availability of weapons is an issue around that, but it is not the same issue.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sure this is not the last time we will have this discussion, as there were legislative efforts to disarm the civilian population that were defeated last year, but we'll see. I'm sure the government hasn't quite given up on those yet.
Battle won, war still on.
Indeed. All right. So it's a bit of a slow news day, and I was looking for stories to talk about today, and I was just struck by this piece from News 24 about Bekele. So we've bashed him quite a lot in the past couple of weeks on the show, but the intro to this is just incredible. So Bekele has been doing a lot of touring around the country in response to the terrible spate of tavern shootings, and just there have been a lot of very public gruesome murders and crime incidents recently, and I think there's a sort of this issue of murder is right in the spotlight at the moment, which it hasn't been for a while. So Becky clearly is going around the country talking to communities, trying to kind of fix government's reputation on this one. Let me just read to you the intro to the story, because I think it says something about the sort of silliness of the moment we're in. Police Minister Bheki Cele received a hero's welcome in Khayelitsha, Cape Town on Monday, singing, joking, and in a long off-the-cuff speech cast a net of responsibility for crime further than the officers in the patrolling police bucky. Fresh from his commiseration visit to Johannesburg on Sunday after a shooting spree in the township, Cele arrived at the Desmond Tutu Community Hall in Makhaza, Cape Town, to Gloria Gaynor's "I Will Survive," belted out for him by the police band. A praised poet spoke words of tribute to him and the late Nelson Mandela as the country marked the birthday of South Africa's first democratically elected president. To be expected, after this sort of, shall we say, fairly jolly arrival of the police minister in Khayelitsha, there were some community members who expressed their concerns about the sort of general conditions they were living in and the high rate of crime. One person in the audience said, "We are people, we are not animals." At one point during Bekele's long speech, he went on to talk about how you can't devolve police powers. There was the Western Cape MEC for police oversight and community safety, who then sort of kind of had to argue with him, because, of course, it's the Western Cape's position that there is space for police devolution. Bekele simply kind of said, "Oh, well, I can't be a constitutional delinquent. It's against the Constitution." He then went on a sort of strange tirade about why spot checks were not being carried out on foreign-owned spas shops, and then went on to talk about how women don't have the tools to rape, and if men just stopped raping, there would be no rape. So that's a that's a whole thorny issue of itself. But I don't know, Terrence, you know, you just sort of despair, because it just it's a farce.
You know, here's an uncomfortable thought that, as far as like experience in the portfolio goes, Bheki Cele probably has more experience with policing than any of other ministers do in their portfolios. I mean, he had a brief ride as National Police Commissioner, and Johan Burger at the ISS, who I quite admire, actually said he was quite operationally focused. So seem to know more about actual policing than, let's say, Jackie Salebi, for instance.
Jackie Salebi was the pinnacle of police etiquette.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but, you know, odious comparisons. There is something I would like to say farcical, but I think a better word is performative. You know, I don't really know the place of praise singers in any African culture or an African culture more generally, but it does seem to me that praise singing does not have just seems out of place with a member of the citizen executive of a constitutional republic. You know, as for the "I will survive" and whatever, once again, it's
poor choice of song.
Yeah, it's performative. He's correct in a sense that it's not just about about policing. But I think that the areas where policing counts, like, you know, being willing to assist people who find themselves at the receiving end of criminality, or, you know, providing a visible and deterrent presence. Yes, those are things that the police should be doing, and things that the police should not be doing. You know, accepting backhanders or whatever, or making sure that files get shredded. I think we've heard so many stories about that. That today, I think that there is some polling evidence that shows that police in South Africa are one of the least trusted institutions. It's not a happy situation, and, you know, "I will survive" and a, you know, funky fedora doesn't compensate.
Londi, just to close out the episode, very briefly, Are you impressed with the performance of the police minister in this circumstance?
Definitely not. I'm not impressed, and I believe that the powers of policing should definitely be devolved. It's definitely not good there. So, and Bateman isn't doing a good job either. So that's why I believe that it should be devolved.
No, I think that's definitely one of the key pieces in reforming the police, at least in the medium term, to get us back on track, to get communities more in touch with their police rather than having Pretoria control them all. But anyway, that is a discussion for another day. We are out of time, so thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please like the video, subscribe to our channel, leave us good podcast reviews, support the Institute of Race Relations, read the Daily Friend, and all that good stuff. And I hope you have a great, fantastic, wonderful, and magnificent day. And we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend. Cheers, everyone.